Freedom Fiends. And this is the Freedom Fiends Weekend Edition, broadcasting from the Wormabago One Mobile Command Studio, Modular Studio, I should have said, in the depths of Freedom Bayou, where the swamp meets the sea and where no revenue or dare set foot. Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. You can learn more about that at BIPCOT.org. That's BIPCOT.org. And my name is Ben Stone. Joining me by way of Fiendphone Satellite Technology is Jim Jesus. Jim, how's things in Vegas?
Awesome. I love it here.
I've only been in Vegas a few times, and in passing and for one wedding. And it was always a pretty cool experience. I lived in Reno for a few years. I really like that up there. But I like the whole Nevada mindset. I don't know if that makes any sense to anybody that has never been to Nevada.
Yeah, there's kind of a feeling here where you're just basically not in America, but you technically are still in America. We have all sorts of things that would not be permitted anywhere else, but we have it here. So, and when you said you went to a wedding, was Elvis the person who was conducting the wedding?
No, it was just one of those real quick, wedding chapel weddings, and everybody threw popcorn or something. It was pretty ridiculous. There were a lot of, this was in the 70s, and there were mini skirts involved.
called Fallout New Vegas. And instead of having, like we do here, a bunch of Elvis Presley impersonators, they have Elvis Costello impersonators, which is, it almost seems like kind of like a budget way of doing things, you know, like, oh, we couldn't afford the real Elvis impersonator, so we got the Elvis Costello impersonator. But until I see that, my life is incomplete.
That's pretty funny. Elvis Costello impersonators. Oh, wow. So
and fittingly, back in the day, there used to be a thing where people would go and gamble during the day, and at night they would go and watch the atom bombs, which is fitting considering what today is.
Yeah, yeah. It is the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki in Japan, August 9th, 1945. And we were going to touch on that a little bit with it being that date. One of the things I wanted to bring up was who should be responsible for crimes. Like, it was kind of ironic that right after the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, just right after that, they had the Nuremberg trials in Germany where they tried people for war crimes. And, even people in the day, even people that were contemporary to the events of the day, were stepping back saying, well, why wasn't Nagasaki a war crime? I mean, if you really look at it, I know this is going out on the radio in a lot of, small towns across America, and on a Sunday afternoon Sunday afternoon, well, according to where you're at when it's playing, but. That might be something shocking for somebody to hear on the radio, is that, yeah, the completely unnecessary bombing of Nagasaki and all the murder of all the children and the people who had nothing to do at all with the war, that was a war crime. And it was just as bad as the war crimes that the Germans did or that the Japanese did in, Nanking or any of the other war crimes. I mean, a war crime is a war crime. When you destroy children and people's lives, and, how is that any different because of the color of their skin or the location that they happen to randomly be born at? It's a weird thing to think about.
Yeah, and a lot of people who would say that that's evil, that you would say that America's involved in a war crime, would rightfully point out that America was involved in a war crime in Vietnam during the My Lai massacre, which, has the same justifications, except, there's no personality in our person, it wasn't personal if dropping a bomb from the sky rather than going on foot and shooting people in their face. So,
that's a particularly despicable part of modern warfare too, is this idea that that people can be in a comfortable setting pushing a button and murdering people at a long distance and not seeing their faces, not watching their bodies burn, not having to step over a corpse, and somehow that's okay. But if you're right there and you're holding the pistol to the person's head and you're pulling the trigger, then that's a horrible, horrible crime. But as long as you know, there in Nevada is where, you know, there's guys sitting in trailers outside of Las Vegas looking at monitors, pushing buttons, and people get incinerated mm-hmm. around the other side of the world. And the guy just, you know, when he gets done, he, you know, finishes his bologna sandwich and goes down to the Coke machine and gets a Coke and comes back and see if he has to push the button again. It's a bizarre concept.
And what's weirder is that people who go into war and shoot people in their face come back with PTSD symptoms, but their symptoms aren't as bad as people who navigate drones from far away. There's been reports about people who are pilots of these drones and were bombing people having worse cases of PTSD than people who weren't actually there, which is, you know, kind of, it's a bit telling that, you know, after a while that gets to you that it's worse on the psyche.
Yeah, it would have to. I mean, it just would eat at your mind, because I was reading the account of one of those guys that had stopped doing it, and he said that on his monitor he could see, it's kind of a, because they look right through the roof. They can see right through the roofs of the buildings that they're getting ready to blow up. Mm-hmm. And he could see something small moving around, and his superiors were telling him, oh, it's a dog. You know, it's just a dog. Don't worry about it. But he could tell by the movements that it was not a dog. It was a child. And, you know, and he had to push the button anyway. And he did it. And it just, like, ate at him because he knew what he had done. And maybe if you're flying at 40,000 feet in a bomber and you're pushing a button, maybe there's a different scope to it, because you're not, like, those drone flyers are literally looking at a monitor, seeing a heat blob on their monitor that just slowly goes to, you know, to room temperature, goes to neutral, and they know what has happened, and, you know, they can actually see the bleed out of the victim that they've bombed as the heat escapes their body and their blood runs out onto the ground. They actually see that on their monitor. That's got to be just mind-boggling. That's just got to eat at you, you know?
It would eat at me.
Yeah.
I could never live with myself if I was doing something like that, but apparently some people can.
You know, but this brings up
not many.
Yeah, exactly. This brings up a different aspect of this, though. You know, you think of what happened at Nagasaki, and as the day goes by, as the show goes through, we'll talk about some of the details of why it was unnecessary. But just for the, if you don't agree with us that Nagasaki was unnecessary, just stick through for a little while and just imagine in your mind, kind of play a little game in your mind. Say, well, what if it wasn't? What if I've been lied to my whole life? And what if Nagasaki was not necessary? Then what does that mean? Well, one of the things it would mean is that the pilot and the air crew that was involved in actually dropping the bombs and not only them, but like the guys who had to load the bombs and the guys who transported the bombs across the ocean on the USS Indianapolis, there's a level of guilt that all of them are going to feel, and they've got to justify that in some way. So as the years go by, you have to you either go insane, or you become just a cold-hearted monster who can't, you know, who just doesn't have feelings about it, or you build up a series of lies that you force upon your mind and you deal with what you have done by lying to yourself over and over and over. And I think that's what ends up happening with a lot of vets. Is that they end up building up a series of lies in their mind, and then they will never go back and revisit those.
Because it's hard to deal with. It's very hard to deal with.
Yeah.
And I would imagine it would be hard for anybody to deal with. But such is life, I guess.
This is kind of goes to what I have been talking about for a couple weeks now about memories and about how eyewitnesses are really unreliable and memories are unreliable because time eats away at memories, and you end up adjusting those memories according to new information that you're given, and according to, like I gave the example, I can't remember if it was last week or the week before, I gave the example of the old guy telling the story of, he was almost 100 years old, and he said that the big difference from when he was a kid was that nothing was colorful. Around 1900, 1905 and stuff like that. He said everything was pretty much gray. There was no real color to anything. And, of course, that's entirely factually wrong. Houses were very colorful. Clothing was very colorful. There was a lot of color in advertisings of the day. There was a lot of color everywhere. It's just that old movies that he had viewed were all in black and white. And so it literally stole the color out of his memory by him not being vigilant with his own mind. And, you know, that's how the mind works. It takes information, it takes new information that's given to it, and constantly adjusts our memory so that it's very rare, actually, that an old memory is all that accurate, you know, because we're constantly introducing new information to the brain.
Yeah. I mean, there were studies done with university professors where they would be giving a talk and then someone would come in and shoot the professor with a gun full of blanks, and the person would run out, and then the professor would get up and say, okay, describe who shot me.
Yeah.
And almost nobody could give an accurate description at all.
Yeah. That's a real good example.
The person came back in the room. They were surprised. Like, oh, I couldn't believe that my description was so far off.
Yeah,
like, different hair color, different ethnicities. You name it. They could not nail it down at all.
Yeah, and that's, you know. And then imagine if you're remembering back some atrocity that you did during a war and trying to justify it in your own mind while explaining to your family members, oh, well, it was a horrible time and people were doing things. You know, just the concept that. You know, most Americans have no idea that U.S. military during World War II were guilty. A lot of the personnel that were in Europe were guilty of a lot of rapes. And that information never got back to the American public. Even nowadays, it's not talked about.
Nope.
Well,
it's sad.
We're going to step away. The market's going to take over momentarily. But we'll be right back.
Worms.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Antiwar, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com.
Shout out to Lou there. We are the Freedom Fiends. And this is the Freedom Fiends. And so, Jim, you know, we were talking before we started the show today that there are, you know, there are war apologists that call themselves libertarians. And even some of the major think tanks have done stuff like, you know, that are considered libertarian in their standing, and yet they've done stuff that sort of says, well, maybe, you know, 90% of war is bad, but you know, if they just do it more efficiently, or if they just do it like this, it would be better. Or, you know, there's I'm thinking of the Cato Institute has done stuff on condemning the Afghanistan war, but then when you find out, if you read on through and you see what they're saying, well, it could have been done more efficiently, or maybe it shouldn't have been like this, or maybe, and it's like, no, you know, I mean, the hard fact is, in my mind, the United States used Afghanistan as the excuse to go over there and do everything that it did, specifically because of the poppy harvest. I mean, I go through and dig through the even if you just go to Wikipedia and you look up the poppy harvest for Afghanistan, and you see where the Taliban cut off, and this is not a big 9/11 conspiracy theory thing either. This is all based on CIA documentation. The Taliban outlawed poppy growing, and the poppy harvest fell to almost zero. And then literally months later, the U.S. invades, and the poppy harvest starts coming right back again. And who's over there guarding the poppy fields now? Hey, guess what? It's mostly American private security that are former military. But there's a lot of Americans that are guarding the poppy fields in Afghanistan today. And why is that? Because war is about making money. That's what war is about. It's about ego and power and, you know, governments arguing about this or that. But ultimately, war is a racket. It's about making money. And a very small group of people make a vast amount of money, and the vast amount of people end up suffering for it, and that's what war is. And I think there's a book, let me stall for a second where I find it here. There's a book called We Who Dare to Say No to War by Murray Polner and Tom Woods that talks mm-hmm. about this really well, and I would really suggest it for people to check it out. I'll say it again, We Who Dared to Say No to War by Murray Polner and Tom Woods. If I can remember, I'll get it in today's show notes. But and another one, too, I'll tell, is War, Christianity, and the State by Lawrence Vance. Lawrence Vance is a kind of a hard-nosed Christian, so he takes that view of war and then goes into it. If a person considers themselves a Christian, really take a look at Lawrence Vance's work, and you'll get a Christian perspective on why war is nothing more than, you know, a money-making scheme for a very small group of people in government. I think I talked myself out there.
And what's interesting about this, it wasn't some libertarians, giving each other, the runaround. No, this was actually written by, like, liberals. Yeah, it was actually written by liberals and conservatives and libertarians across the board. And they were getting perspective from all sides of the story. That's what really makes it an interesting book, so that it's not just one-sided. This is from a variety of opinions, standing up and saying no to war.
Yeah. Yeah, and almost anything Tom Woods gets associated with is a big seller and everything. He's got a big audience, but there's a reason for that. Tom has shifted his view over the years. He used to be a hard-nosed conservative, and he has come to the position that he's in now through being faced with facts and not having a choice. And that's the thing about truth and facts. As you look at them, you have to come to a conclusion of either I'm going to let go of the lies that I believed in, or I'm going to, adopt the truth. And I don't know how a person can face it otherwise. Okay. We only have a couple seconds until the break starts. So how about if I throw out Austin Peters' name and we'll just kind of tease about him and then come back after the break and pound on him a little bit.
That sounds great.
So one prominent, I hate to even say this, prominent libertarian used to work for Napolitano, the judge that abandoned being a judge and became a Fox News and then eventually an anarchist. But Austin Peterson is one of these war apologists. We'll pick on him a little bit when we get back from this break. Stick with us.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Hey, there's some Squizcar Squiggles from Death Clocks. And you are listening to the Freedom Fiends on the, the radios. And I guess I says worms now, so there you go.
tired of those old Freedom Fiends buttons? Well, the Freedom Fiends have new button designs.
As always, it's only $10 for 10 buttons, and you'll get these nifty designs. Buy sheep, for sheep, on sheep.
State speech is hate speech.
Two designs for Guns and Weed, the Road to Freedom.
Three designs for Fiend Phone.
Bipcot No Gov.
A Freedom Fiends Worms button.
And ask me about my worms.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
And now they're bigger buttons.
They used to be 1 1/4 inch. Now they're 1 3/4 inch. Dan, they're bigger buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
So, Jim, I threw out right before the break, I threw out the name Austin Peters. Peterson. You know, before we started the show today, I had mentioned that we were talking about him a little bit. And I mentioned, it's like, does this guy get anything right at all ever? Has he ever said anything that was truthful and correct? Because if so, I haven't read it, you know. It's really weird because it seems like he's an intelligent guy. What I have read of his and when I've heard him in interviews and stuff, it seems like he's an intelligent person, which causes me to worry. What do you think of a person who seems to be intelligent and says really, really stupid things? You know, how can you have a person who is really actually that intelligent and says something so blatantly wrong and so easy to check up on? So, I mean, it's like, you know, it's like walking outside on a bright sunny day and say, ooh, it's cold out here tonight. You know, at what point do you say, well, he's just being dishonest? And I don't know, because I don't know, you know, what's actually in his mind. But it's really hard for me to take him seriously.
Yeah, well, to be fair, he was right about Cantwell, and there's a video of him debating Cantwell that was really great. but I brought this up originally before we went on air, that he wrote this article, or actually did a podcast a while ago, asking whether or not it would be justified to use nukes on Iran, and his thesis was basically, sure, why not? And
wow,
one of my friends. Debated him on his website, and he just had like this third grade civics lesson version of the American, which is actually not true, and it was just absurd. And so basically, the idea that we hear from usually public schools about the Pacific stage on the World War II conflict was that, you know, Japan was going nonstop. They wouldn't surrender. They were even like had kamikaze pilots, and they were just terrible, and they would not stop. And so we had to do something, which is actually not true. What they were doing was they were trying to issue a surrender, and one of the conditions of a surrender was that they would keep the emperor, and that was one point that they would not budge on. And the reason why is because it was important to their religion. The Shinto religion viewed the emperor as somewhat of a semi-deity. And so they would not waver, and there was no support within the government. There was no support with the people. Even in the own military, they couldn't even execute a coup to keep the conflict going because there was just not enough support for it. And even still, we dropped the bomb on them. And then we offered them a conditional surrender, which we didn't want to do originally, that would allow them to keep the emperor. And it was totally unnecessary for us to drop the bomb on them because they were willing to surrender under the conditions that we gave them.
Yeah, and you have to keep in mind also that the bulk of their actual army was essentially surrounded in China and could not even retreat. it was just a matter of, you know, at what point did the Chinese army slap its hands together and crush them? It was getting to that point. And then in addition to that, they had no air force left. The United States had completely destroyed their air force. They could not, by the time that Hiroshima and Nagasaki took place, the Japanese had no planes to put in the air to even oppose the incoming bombers. So they had absolutely no air capability, and they had no naval capability by the time that the atomic bombs were dropped. The entire naval fleet of Japan had either been neutralized, sunk, damaged to the point of where it couldn't go out into open ocean, or it captured. So we're talking about a country at war that cannot make a land-based army maneuver. They can't even retreat. They cannot put a plane in the sky, so they have no air force and they have no navy. Not only that, there was a complete embargo around Japan being a series of islands. They couldn't even get raw material into or out of the islands. So the United States literally had them surrounded, and they were starving to death. And like you mentioned, Jim, the Japanese government had been attempting to surrender. They had contacted the Swiss. They had contacted the Russians, trying to open a channel to the U.S. to surrender. They'd been doing that for months. And then after the United States bombs these two cities, which were, you know, mostly civilian deaths, once that's done, then the United States accepts the exact terms that the Japanese had been trying to surrender for months under. You know, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah, and the reasons used for the justification, you could equally say that's the same thing that's used to justify the My Lai massacre. And everybody rightfully condemns that. Yeah, this is the same thing, except the only difference is that we didn't go into Nagasaki and Hiroshima just annihilating women, children. We did that from a plane thousands of feet in the air. That's the only difference.
And I know we're on the radio in places where people are literally coming home from Sunday school or coming home from church on a Sunday, and they might be hearing this on the radio, and they might not know anything about who the Freedom Fiends are or whatever. We're not leftists. We're not, you know, we're not hating America or bashing America or anything like that. We are simply trying to tell the truth. And the truth is the government in D.C., not the American people or the American culture or, you know, human beings living in North America. We're not attacking any of those things. We're saying that the government in Washington, D.C. has systematically lied to its people, and the people in Washington, D.C., in the government, were the ones that made the decision, and they knew exactly what they were doing. They knew Japan was trying to surrender. They knew those cities were not military targets, and they knew that this was just basically, you know, they had made these bombs, they had spent a massive amount of money on these bombs, and they had a new toy, they wanted to try it out. And it really gets down to being, you know, that simple as to why they would go and incinerate people like that.
Yeah. And it's sad.
It really is.
Absolutely sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then,
you think of all the countless of lives of people who died or became sick with leukemia because of, you know, all the ill effects of radiation. And it was totally unjustified.
Yeah,
on every single level. It was totally unjustified.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, you know, since this is Sunday and we are, you know, like I said, catching people coming home from church or whatever, there's something that a Christian should think about with this, too. There was a large Christian population in Japan, but it was almost entirely in the city of Nagasaki. Christianity had been outlawed. There was some Christian missions that came to Japan in, I think it was about the mid-1600s or so, and there was a small Christian movement that really kind of took off in Japan. And then the missionaries were all expelled, and Christianity was outlawed in Japan. And it stayed that way for a couple hundred years. But then in the late 1800s, there was a sort of a relaxing of Japanese law, and Christianity was no longer against the law. So this underground group of Christians who had been, they were Japanese, but they were Christians, and they had been hiding their religion for hundreds of years in Japan, could now come out in the open and admit to being Christians and so forth. And so they built this cathedral in Nagasaki, and it was a huge, beautiful cathedral. It was the largest cathedral in the Far East, in all of the Far East, and this includes, you know, it was bigger than any cathedral, like in even down in Australia or New Zealand, or, you know, in English speaking places like that. It was bigger than any cathedral in China or India or anything. It was a huge Christian cathedral, and it was literally right in the middle of Nagasaki. And now the really nasty part of this is when the American bomber flew over Nagasaki, they were given orders to use that structure as their targeting point, as at their point that they used to target it with. And this bomb was dropped on a Sunday morning, by the way. It was a Sunday morning when that church literally was full of worshipers in there, and they specifically had, there were nuns in that church, there were priests, Catholic priests in that church, they had an all-girls school that was in attendance on that particular morning. And that's the point where the bomb exploded directly over top of that church. And so they got the first blow of the heat coming down and boiling right through the roof of that church and cooking all of those Christians alive right in there in that church. So any Christian who's listening to this needs to recognize that, you know, the propaganda in America at the time was all drawing the Japanese as being these barbaric, uncivilized, heathen monsters. And really and truly, as a for a Christian thinking about this, you have to realize that if when you justify the bombing of Nagasaki, you are justifying the murder of thousands of Christians who were there in attendance at that church and were cooked alive for something the governments were arguing about. Those people in that town had nothing to do with any of this stuff.
And a lot of those military bases, which they were targeting, I don't know about that city, but I know that Hiroshima, they targeted the civilian center of that city, even though the military bases were off to the outskirts of the city, and a lot of them actually survived the damage of the bomb. So if we're saying that, you know, we were going after military targets, it's not exactly true, because effectively that's what they did not hit. They hit the civilian centers and just annihilated innocent women and children, and even men, who we don't know whether or not they would have been sympathetic to the American view of things, and not the, you know, the imperialist Japanese.
Yeah, and then, you know, like we were talking about before, to try to justify that afterwards. So where do you lay blame on something like this? Do you say, well, it's the fault of the guys who gave the order, knowing that the Japanese were trying to surrender, and the DC government, they knew the Japanese were trying to surrender. They knew that this was not a military target. They knew the Japanese would surrender one way or the other, and yet they did this anyway. So who carries the guilt here? Does the the Pentagon elites that made the decision? Does the president at the time that made the decision? Are they the ones guilty for giving the order? Is the guy in the airplane that pushed the button? Is the navigator that put them over that cathedral as the target? You know, where does the guilt lie, and how do you deal with that? And then to think, okay, now here we are 70 years later, who's guilty now when they lie and cover up, you know, these atrocities? Isn't there still guilt when historians and history teachers and others lie about what really happened?
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty Talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Meow, meow, meow.
Freedom Fiends.
Freedom Fiends.
And we have a treat for you. We have another fiend that's dropped in. Hugo, welcome to the show.
Hello, everyone. This is Hugo from Mexico. Doing the fiends here and learning about this great history that Ben and Jim are dropping on us.
So before the break hit us, I was talking about, it was pretty negative, I guess. I'm talking about Nagasaki and the targeting of the largest Christian cathedral in the Far East, using that as a targeting point for the explosion and the incineration of, you know, the school that was there with all the children in it, and the murder of all those nuns and the priests that were there, you know. And it would be, what would Christians think about that if it wasn't a Japanese city that was incinerated like that? If it wasn't a Japanese cathedral, what would happen? What would people think about it if the war had been different and it had been Mexico City and a cathedral in Mexico City had been used as the target? Or what would have happened if Rome would have been used as the target? How would Christians today view such a bombing? It would be really difficult to justify such horror. But for some reason, because it was Japanese people, I think Americans choose not to think about it, which is a really weird thing to me.
Well, it is a really weird thing, especially for Christians, to not talk about that. And it's been discussed many times that the targeting of Nagasaki instead of, say, Dresden, which was horribly bombed, but people will forget the firebombing of Dresden. But they will... you cannot possibly forget one of the two only nuclear attacks ever done on a city.
Yeah.
And would you say it was racist? I don't know what the word would be, but just tactically intelligent for them in a very evil way.
Yeah, and something else I was bringing up before the break too was how do you assign blame? You know, the president made the decision. The Pentagon, high ups in the Pentagon, were in on the decision. The pilot and the air crew had to decide, yes, we'll obey orders. So isn't there some level of guilt when you decide to obey orders when, to do something like that? And what about the guys that were loading the plane and loading that horrible bomb into the plane? And what about the guys on the USS Indianapolis that took the bombs over there for the bombing? And that's kind of an interesting thought with the USS Indianapolis, because there's being a movie shot down here in Alabama about the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. And the I don't know how much the movie is going to go into the controversy on that, but one of the horrible things about the sinking of the Indianapolis was that because it was on the secret mission to deliver the atomic bombs so that they could bomb Japan with them, it was on the return trip from that it was sunk, and the U.S. didn't send out search parties because, since it was on a secret mission, it wasn't common knowledge as to where it was or what it was doing. So it was like 800 or 900 sailors that ended up dying, floating in the water, eaten by sharks, essentially. Mm. Out there floating for days, waiting to be rescued, and nobody came to rescue them because the government couldn't admit, you know, what the mission was and where they were at. So, I mean, it's just levels and levels of evil things that happen because of war.
And then on top of that, like, what if someone does something under the presumption that, you know, they would be tried under the, let's say that America lost the conflict, and then they would end up having to be tried, and then what were they going to say? Like, well, we're just following orders.
Yeah.
You know, so they wouldn't accept that excuse as well. So there has to be some conflict in someone's head when they're committing these atrocities that they could end up paying the price for it, you know, they could lose the war and they could be held accountable.
You know that?
Yeah, they could die in combat, and that's I find it funny that you can find a people fanatical enough to blow himself or herself up in a market, and you cannot find a single saboteur to, you know, dump the whole mission.
Yeah,
the whole nuclear bomb. Just if you have just the one saboteur, just the one, the guy loading the bomb, cutting up some wires, some guy on the plane refusing, he would have been shot.
Yeah,
I guess that's kind of redemptive.
You know, let's talk a little bit more about that angle when we come back from the break. Folks, you're going to hear some news during the hour break, but don't let that get to you. We'll have more freedom.
Worms.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio. Worms.
Are you sick of peaceful people being locked away for victimless crimes? Instead of trying to get out of jury duty, consider taking it so you can do the right thing. A single juror with a conscience can send someone home to their family instead of to a jail cell. If there's no victim, how can there be a crime? And if the judge or prosecutor are keeping you in the dark, what are they trying to hide? You can vote your conscience instead of being a pawn of the state. For more information, Google jury nullification or check out the Fully Informed Jury Association at fija.org.
Woof, woof, woof.
Estos son los Freedom Fiends, transmitiendo desde el cañón iónico de baja órbita del campo de reeducación libertario, en la cima de la plaza financiera bestial, en el satélite artificial Lipper 2017, en la región de Alpha Centauri. You're not listening to some kind of Spanish language radio station. It's just that this is Hugo from Mexico, and this is the Freedom Fiends. We're back, and we're covered by a BIPCO no-gov license, which allows everybody but governments to use this content. So we're back, and we have a Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker.
Hey.
And Jim Jesus here.
How's it going?
And we are talking by Fiend Phone Satellite Technology. And so we're bouncing this all around. I'm way out in the remote swamps of Alabama, and Hugo's in Mexico, Jim's in Las Vegas, our GCN studios are up in the Midwest. So we're bouncing this signal all over the place. If you hear any dropouts or delays, it's because of the distance involved and the connections and everything that we're dealing with.
That's what you get for doing a worldwide show.
Yeah. You know, let's see, right before the break, we were talking about guilt, the guilt of doing this kind of stuff. Like, well, you know, actually, a lot of radio stations only pick us up on the second hour on the weekend, so we should probably tell what we're talking about. The topic here that we've been talking about so far is the 70th anniversary. Today, August 9th, 2015 is the 70th anniversary of the United States government dropping an atomic bomb on the city of Nagasaki, August 9th, 1945. And they did so by way of, they used the largest Christian cathedral in the Far East as a targeting device. So they literally, as they flew over the city in their bomber, they used that cathedral as their target, and this was on a Sunday morning when the congregation was present, and there was a children's school that was going on there, a girls' school, and the girls were all in attendance. The children were there. There were nuns. There was priests. This was a Christian congregation in Nagasaki that were annihilated with the flash of that bomb that took place directly over the roof of their building. And you know, this is an aspect of the story that just doesn't get told in the United States. I was never told that growing up in school. They never explained to me that these were this was not a military target. It was, there were no troops in Nagasaki. It was not It was a city that had never been bombed either. It wasn't, so the people were not expecting to be bombed. And like Jim pointed out in the first hour, the Japanese government had been attempting to surrender. They had tried in numerous ways to surrender, and the only condition that they had for surrender was that they, you know, that the United States leave their emperor, which was part of their religion. And when the United States eventually accepted the surrender of Japan, they did so with those conditions that Japan had been trying to surrender for months. So it wasn't like they gained anything in the negotiation by exterminating these human beings. They gained nothing in it. And then, I didn't mention this in the first hours, but since I'm on a rant, I'll go ahead. Major military figures, including the admiral that was in charge of the war in the Pacific at the time, had said this is not a military, it's not militarily justifiable to bomb these two cities, Nagasaki and Hiroshima. In addition to that, MacArthur, who was in charge of the land war in the Pacific realm, he said that it was not a military target and it had no military function. It had it didn't help the outcome of the war in any way. So here's two of the two top military leaders for the Pacific war, which was MacArthur, and I think the other one was Nimitz or Halsey. I always get those two guys mixed up. I think it was Nimitz. Anyway, both of them condemned the dropping of the bombs and said it was not necessary. So if anybody ever would have been able to say, oh yeah, there was a reason for it, it would have been those two guys. And they said, no, there's no reason for it.
And like I pointed out in the last hour as well, is that even in the Hiroshima, which was a military target, they attacked or they hit the centers of the civilians, and the military bases were on the outliers of the city, and not all of them were destroyed because of the bombing. It was so far away. It was hit at the civilian centers, not towards where the military bases were. And so that has to be taken into account as well.
Now, Hugo, before the break there at the hour, Hugo had mentioned something that's a really interesting thought, and that is, what can a saboteur do? Had there been just one guy that could have looked at the situation and said, you know, this is really, really messed up, and, you know, just clipped some wires, or, you know, just accidentally dropped something somewhere, or the word saboteur comes from an old word, sabot, which means a shoe, and it literally meant, it was a reference to protesters who would throw their shoe into the machines of a factory to shut the factory down. And so that's why it's named after the sabot, after the shoe. So, you know, all it would have taken is somebody dropping a shoe into the works of all this, and it could have saved hundreds of thousands of people, or at least just near 100,000 people. And all the torturous death that comes in the years afterwards, too, those people are generally not counted in the numbers. But like Jim said before the break, you know, there were people that were suffering from the burns and from the radiation poisoning for years, decades after this took place.
It's especially relevant with regards to Nagasaki, because this was the second bombing. So
yeah.
they were pretty much, they were aware of what was going to happen. Maybe in Hiroshima they weren't, but in Nagasaki they were aware of what would happen, and it was a second bombing. I don't know if it was announced at some point, which would have been a bigger hit to them if somebody just prevented the second bombing from happening. So yes, it would have changed the whole outcome of at least that part of the war. And what's the worst thing that can possibly happen to you if you're a saboteur for the military? They can shoot you on sight if it's obvious enough that it was you, or they could make a court martial and sentence you to death by firing squad. That's the worst thing that can possibly happen. I'm not sure how is that so different from a suicide bomber who knows he's gonna die, but his beliefs are strong enough. I don't know. That's probably why there aren't any Quakers on bombers.
Maybe
probably. I don't know. Yeah. So where are those people? And I think, well, it's, well, I'll, I'll, um, I use the fact that I'm in Mexico so I can say these things. So where are those people? Where are those people? Where's the guys that would do that for, I don't know, for peace, for human lives? I'm pretty sure that those people are there. Those people are around. And maybe they don't want to go into the military for obvious reasons. I'm not sure.
You know, here's a thought experiment. I have read that during the early stages of the Second World War, the Nazis used forced labor, Jewish forced labor, to assemble rifles and to do other kinds of, build munitions and so forth. And it's my understanding that a lot of those Jews that were forced to build the war machine for Germany responded by, like, setting the sights slightly off on rifles, or, removing key parts in assembling munitions. They would remove key parts so that the bomb wouldn't explode, or the bullet wouldn't fire correctly, or they would do other things like that in the manufacture of German arms to try to to do their little part. And I wonder how many people in the United States, working for the United States government, maybe, in the drone programs nowadays, we were picking on the drone flyers earlier in the last hour. I wonder what would happen if more and more consciences were to open to the things that we're talking about, and people in the manufacturing of the drones, or people, in the flight aspects of the drones, would, if there's ways that they could put something, do something. I don't even know, because I don't know enough about it, but do something somewhere in the process that would, throw off the aim by 15 degrees or something like that. Isn't there someone out there that can do something like that?
I'm pretty sure there's somebody out there who can do that, and I'm pretty sure that if such a thing happened, they would go out as a regular, normal, a government misfunction or government laziness in production, because military industry is a government enterprise, is a government business, and all government business work less well than private business does.
Right.
So yeah, even privatized businesses that are working for the state under contract don't do that well of a job as
right.
So.
Yeah, they have a lot of money, and they throw money at things when things go get late or get delayed at some point, have some kind of trouble. I think we were I've read a bit about one of the new fighter airplanes, which is just garbage, and yeah, they won't scrape it. they won't scrap the whole project. So that could, just go out as normal. The things are going badly and production is not going as we expected, and even though it's been intentional.
That's kind of what, wasn't Schindler from Schindler's List, isn't that kind of what he did with his factories, sort of intentionally slow down production and intentionally produce, bad product?
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that. It would be an interesting thing to talk about. I'm interested.
That could be some very serious activism for a person. There would be, like Hugo mentioned a minute ago, there would be tremendous risk in something like that. But man, think of the emotional reward. If you could think to yourself, well, I may have just saved a family from being incinerated by a Hellfire missile. If somebody out there has a conscience on something like that, think of the level of activism. Now, that would be a rewardless, a thankless job, because you could never admit that you had done it. They would definitely come after you hard and heavy.
They'll probably shoot you.
Yeah. Very good
marshal, but yeah. But that's what happens with really, really, really brave activists. Where things are happier.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
For some reason in this country, and in most of the Western world, it's okay to just judge.
Hey, this is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends radio show. Computer programmer Derek Slopey and I have created FiendPhone. I'm using FiendPhone right now to talk with and record one of my co-hosts in real time. Take it, Davi.
Hey, this is Davi Barker, and I'm 1,000 miles away from Michael, but we sound like we're in the same room.
We sure do, Davi. So, Davi, please tell the nice people more about FiendPhone.
FiendPhone is free, no-gov software that opens up a global world of possibilities for collaborative, high-quality, remote voice media production, and I'm digging it.
People can try FiendPhone right now at FiendPhone.com, but we're also raising money to vastly improve FiendPhone and vastly improve independent talk media worldwide.
So go to FiendPhone.com to help out. Who will build the audio roads? We will, with your help.
That's FiendPhone.com, FiendPhone.com. Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, phone.com.
FiendPhone, I never knew remote audio could be this good.
My fellow sheep, election season is upon us. Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. Our democracy depends on it. We're an organization called Citizens Against Too Much Unfettered Freedom, or CATMUF. CATMUF is a bipartisan flock of sheep whose goal is expanding government until nothing else remains. Because the government is here to help you. How can you help CATMUF help you? By only voting for candidates dedicated to expanding government. It's easy. You don't need to study the issues. No matter what a politician says when running for office, they're all dedicated to expanding government. And make sure you tell all your friends and family to vote for more government. Here at CATMUF, we don't care if you vote Democrat or Republican, as long as you vote for candidates committed to growing our federal family. CATMUF, because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
Pouring molten truth down your ear hole. Yeah, so I guess we should try to bring this into a positive. It's kind of hard to think of anything positive, though, when you've already got the thing hanging over your head that 70 years ago today, you know, a Christian cathedral full of children and worshipers was used as a target and were incinerated for political reasons, having nothing to do with the war, having nothing to do with those people were not a threat to anyone. They did probably, I would say the vast majority of people that died at Nagasaki probably had no idea that Pearl Harbor had taken place 4 years earlier. You know, the odds are they didn't have any knowledge of that because it's not necessarily something that the Japanese government would have bragged about. So you can't really assign them blame for that, even if that's your justification for bombing them.
Yeah. And look, and what was interesting when you were talking about, you know, a saboteur, there actually was a case where something like this happened when they were doing the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, where they went into a city and just firebombed everybody and shot everybody in their faces. Women, children, didn't matter if they were sympathizers to the North Vietnamese at all. They just went in and just annihilated them. And when they were planning this out, one of the pilots, the helicopter pilots, famously said that, you know, he would not do it. And if they did try to do it, that he would turn their his helicopter guns on people. His troops had a big trial about it, and you know, a lot of people were punished for this because it was a war crime. It was an atrocity. It was unjustifiable. And, you know, something like that could have happened. They could have threatened to shoot down the plane you know, that was carrying the bomb. But, you know, I think it was a top secret operation. So there's that.
Yeah, only trustworthy, and I'm putting air quotes around that, people were involved in the project. It's similarly to the developers of the whole atomic project. Some of them were coerced, but at any rate, they were all, you know, set in with their families up there working on the bomb. So it's a very controlled environment. And I wanted to mention that it's a form of very evil poetry that they literally rain fire from the skies, from heaven, because the atomic bomb doesn't impact doesn't go off when it's near the ground. It goes off several feet above ground to maximize the impact. So those people were vaporized from above, not on contact with the ground.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's literally a fireball that comes down. It rains fire from the sky in an atomic blast like that. The fire literally comes from the sky, and when you think about that as happening to a Christian church, that Christians were sitting, you know, on pews in a Christian church, and fire rained out of the sky and incinerated them. That is just a wild thing to think about.
It's really, really twisted and evil, I think. But yeah, you know, all over the world, there isn't the apology or the justification that goes on in the U.S. or in America with the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but there's this whole thing that probably that's the way it had to end. That's probably the way the war had to end. Even though I don't live in the U.S. and I've heard this in both Mexico and Venezuela, which are Western countries in Latin America. And many people do think it was horrible, but many people do think that's pretty much the way the war had to end. And when I remember having read in my elementary school history book, just two bombs were thrown in these cities and Japan surrendered.
Yeah,
that was the story.
Mm-hmm.
Which is probably pretty much what you read on your own history books growing up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the view that everybody has. It's a very elementary school civics lesson version of what really happened. And they don't talk about how Japan was trying to surrender for months, and under the conditions that we ended up taking their conditional surrender as, because we wanted an unconditional surrender. But that's not what we got.
This is
as if I have a mouse in my pocket, right?
As far as I know, they did get a conditional surrender, but they only gave the conditions to, I don't know, to maybe seem benevolent afterwards, just to, you know, seem like a good winner. Because as far as I remember, they decided to give the Japanese their emperor back.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was the historically accurate.
Yeah, they allowed them to keep their emperor. We'll be right back, folks.
Well,
we're going to step out to the market.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum. When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the Fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
Freedom Fiends. This is where the cats and the birds coexist in peace. And we're coming back from the story of Nagasaki, which were the anniversary of that detonation, that bomb use on Japan is near. What's the day there, Ben?
Yeah, it's 70th anniversary today, August 9th, 1945. So yeah, 70 years to the day.
Wow. So we already talked a bit about the conditions of that attack and how it was rained on civilian population, in which the largest cathedral in the Far East. And there was an aftermath of that, which was part of it was just horrifying radiation sickness and long lasting consequence for the people of that city.
Yeah,
and cancers. Later on, some other governments jumped in after that and decided they wanted to have their own nuclear weapons. Isn't it the case? So, Ben.
Yeah, it's. And then, you know, the United States is weird about that, the United States government. And to a certain extent, a lot of the people in the United States as well, they are perfectly comfortable with their own government having these monstrous weapons, but they get really worried about some other foreign country that might have it. Like, I mean, there are lots of countries that have atomic weapons. You know, Pakistan has atomic weapons. India has atomic weapons. France, of course, Germany, England, Israel. But, you know, the idea that North Korea or, you know, Iran or somebody else might have that is just terrifying to some people. We were picking on Austin Peterson a little earlier, and he, you can tell by his writings, he's really paranoid about North Korea and Iran, which is comedic in every way because, of course, it's against religious law in Iran to make a bomb, and the Ayatollah has come right out and said that it's absolutely against Islam to have or to even go, you know, in the direction of research that creates an atomic bomb. The Ayatollah has forbidden it in Iran, and yet there are many Americans who are terrified that Iran is trying to get an atomic bomb. And then you think of North Korea. Here's a country that, you know, I mean, the whole, you look at it in Google, there's the pictures of North Korea and South Korea from space with the lights on. North Korea doesn't really even have electricity. They have, you know, no resources to speak of. It's a country that is economically a disaster from communism. And somehow this tiny little country on the other side of the world has Americans fearful that they might, you know, do something evil. And these, their own tests, they haven't been able to get a rocket that has the power to really even get any distance out into the ocean, much less carry a warhead, much less have a warhead that actually functions. And yet so many Americans are terrified of these little countries that, you know, are somehow, we're supposed to be afraid of them, that they might get a bomb like this. And when the United States has hundreds of them, I don't even know, maybe thousands.
Yeah, after the Cold War ended, it was known that the United States had much more nuclear weapons than Russia did. And Russia was bragging about them having, you know, thousands of nuclear warheads, which was not the case, just because of the same reason that North Korea hasn't been successful in delivering, in possessing a nuclear bomb that can be delivered because of, you know, sheer poverty. Poverty. They had in the USSR, they had to divert all the resources into bomb and plane and space capsule making, mm-hmm. even though their population were literally starving and spending hours in line to get bread. And there's five countries that are allowed or that just designated nuclear weapon states by the Treaty of the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. These are the good guys. Quote. It's China, France, Russia, United Kingdom, and the United States, and those are the ones who are allowed. And they jumped on the bandwagon pretty soon. I believe France did their own nuclear test in 1950 something, and the last of those was China. But they are officially allowed. I don't know what the criterion is to allow them officially to possess nuclear weapons. And there are some others which are. We have already tested them, which is India, Pakistan, and North Korea. And Israel is suspected and believed to have nuclear weapons. And some other are just riding along in Belgium, Germany, the Netherlands, Italy, Turkey. And they have weapons. They have their own bombs, but they did not make them. Mm-hmm. And also the old USSR republics that went that became independent. That's a nuclear club.
Yeah, like what I think is really scary is people talk about like, oh, we can go in and you know take out North Korea, no problem. The problem with North Korea, if we go to war with them, isn't that they're going to be a threat to us, but it's going to be a threat to their own people. They are perfectly willing to just annihilate their whole entire population and use them as hostages in order to stop us from invading. And that's the really scary part. It's not that they would use nuclear weapons on us. It's that they're going to use nuclear weapons on their own people if if we try to intervene in that. And people want to intervene in that. And that's the scary thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. People think that governments are very different, but I would say they're different within their own borders and population. But they have to play by the rules in the club when they're dealing with other governments. And that's in that sense, all governments are very much the same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to realize that we're talking about their people, you know, we think of governments as almost like it's an entity of its own. But really and truly, it's individual people making decisions that they will never be held responsible for. So that's why people in government can make these decisions about war and about bombing innocent civilians and about doing these horrible things, because they know they're never going to be held responsible for their actions. They're going to get away with it. That's the thing that government does. It lets people get away with their actions. Something earlier, I think, Jim, you mentioned that if the war had gone differently, who would have been tried, you know, in war crimes. And a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned the pilot, Jaeger. His first name jumps out of my mind, which is really strange because my dad knew him. They were old pilot buddies together. But anyway, this well-known pilot, Chuck Jaeger, that broke the sound barrier, and he was a real successful pilot in World War II. He actually said, he made the comment, and this is a quote out of his autobiography. He said when he was ordered to go and fly down on civilian populations and shoot them with his airplane, he said to his other pilots, "We'd better hope that we win this thing." And his intention was, if we don't win, we're going to be standing trial for these crimes that we're doing. And he knew that at the time, and he has admitted that was the worst time of his life, was following those orders to kill civilians that were just trying to escape the burning cities.
Yeah, and it's pretty much impossible to be responsible for those killings. I mean, how we are liberty-minded people, and we follow the idea of the non-aggression principle, and that people should pay retribution or pay some kind of punishment when they violate those things. But it is pretty much impossible to respond, to answer for those crimes. How can you possibly restore or be how can you possibly be punished for killing, I don't know, 1,000 people?
Yeah.
And we're horrified when there's a guy comes into a movie theater and kills 50 people, and we find no way in our hearts to punish that person, to expect that your people are dead, and there's no way of retributing anything to the aggressor. So let's imagine just 1,000 people, 2,000, 100,000 people. You cannot possibly answer for that, and that's a thing only governments can possibly do.
Yeah, no, I think it was Bob Higgs that said about anarchists. He said no anarchist ever committed genocide. No anarchist ever bombed a city. No anarchist ever, you know, and you take that further. No anarchist comes up behind you in traffic and flips their lights on and pulls you over and drags you out of your car for not having your seatbelt buckled, or for not, you know, turning your turn signal correctly, or, you know, for having the wrong sticker on your car. No anarchist is going to pull you over and beat you for that, or even charge you $100 ticket or whatever. That's not what anarchists do. We're going to say, you know, as long as you're not harming anyone, then we have no right to interfere with you. That's the beauty of anarchism, that I don't have the right to interfere with you as long as you're not interfering with me. You're not interfering with anybody else. You're driving down the road with your turn signal on or not on, and that's not a crime that I should be able to stop you and pull you out of the car and force you to, you know, to behave in a certain way and beat you or kill you if you don't cooperate. So it's not anarchists that caused the problem.
Or even worse, what happened in, what was it, Indiana, where they shot that guy in the head for not having a front license plate.
Oh, yeah.
And now he's being tried for murder. Yeah, yeah, so there's a little bit of positive that comes out of it, but this is something we see all the time, is someone gets pulled over for something like having a taillight out, but it's not an anarchist who comes over and pulls you out of your car or shoots you in the head, you know.
I guess, Hugo, that's probably something that's pretty foreign to you, because it's my understanding that the cops don't behave like that in Mexico.
That's true, they don't. Well, there's always, for example, if you want to talk about police beating people and killing people, you have to, here in Mexico, you have to look to the military, where they are doing, when they're doing drug raids and they're doing, you know, they're looking for political dissidents in our country, in the States, all the regions of Mexico. There have been reports of them killing killing people, killing students, killing that has happened, but you don't encounter them on an everyday basis on the street. You actually do find them, and sometimes they go after you. And if your paperwork isn't the way they want it to be, if you don't have the right sticker, or if according to their interpretation you gave you did a wrong turn, or you went in, with your car where you shouldn't have been going, so you can negotiate a bribe. And that's pretty foreign to American people. that the fact that you could possibly, you know, actually, I would think, I wouldn't think of it as a bribe. You're negotiating the fee for the you know, the ticket. It's well, first let's negotiate. Who are we paying it to? The government or yourself? And then what's the amount? And that's pretty, I would say that's an honest negotiation.
Yeah.
But we don't find that here in Mexico. And that's a good thing. We don't want more dead people.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Wake up and smell the freedom. One of the easiest things you can do to help Liberty is to torrent Freedom Fiends episodes to help keep them drone-proof. You can set up your home computer to download and share Freedom Fiends archives over BitTorrent. You can even set up scheduling so it only shares while you're asleep or at work. Put your unused computing power to work and help keep the Freedom Fiends around well into the future. Simply go to freedomfiends.com and click on the Torrent Club link and learn how to torrent and share Freedom Fiends archives. Meow, meow.
And we're wrapping up the hour with me, Ben Stone, with Hugo and Jim Jesus. And we've been talking kind of around the anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki 70 years ago. But also during the break, we were talking about the difference in dealing with cops in Mexico. And Jim told tell that what you were talking about Tijuana and the at least the parts that you can tell.
So, when I was younger, before I turned 21, it was a really easy trip to go from where I was from, Riverside, California, to across the border in Tijuana, where you can go and drink like you're 21. And so I made the terrible mistake and the horrible crime of stepping outside of a club with a beer in my hand and was, you know, accosted by the federales, which are the police in there. And they were polite enough to take me to the nearest ATM so I could take some money.
Good old Mexico. And it's been slowly changing for the worse. Some people are now of the idea, you know, how we have to fix this. We have to not be corrupt. You know, like the citizens, quote, are the ones that are being corrupt, you know. Being corrupt themselves, giving money, and being corrupted, and corrupting the policemen by giving them money. You know, those poor souls, and and people are changing in the more urban areas, in the capital city, and the richer areas of Mexico City, into not giving the bribes. But they're not becoming libertarians. They're not saying, you know, we shouldn't be paying these guys money. They're saying we should be paying money to these guys' bosses for, you know, into a ticket and formally issued a bit of paper, piece of paper, so we can sign it and we can maybe deduct it from our income tax. So that's changing for the worse a bit. And I don't know. I find this is always the case with large, rich cities. They always tend to go left.
Yeah.
Well, you know, an inch on our leash is better, right? We want another inch on our leash.
Yeah.
Yeah. We all want a longer leash. Or in the case of a bird, a bigger cage.
Yeah. There's a lot more honesty, though, in a situation like in Mexico, what we're describing, where you know, you do something wrong and the cop says, well, you know, give me $100 and I'll forget about it. And you say, well, I don't have I can't give you $100. I can give you 50. And he says, well, you know, maybe 75. And you say, how about if I give you 65? And he agrees to it. And you know you're being robbed, and he knows he's robbing you. Like Hugo, like you said, he does it because he can. And there's a certain amount of honesty in that type of robbery where, you know, what we have here in the United States, it hides the responsibility under so many levels of government that people tend to not realize they're being robbed. And in ways it's worse because you know, you have generations of people who don't understand that they are being robbed. It's just not being done directly. And Hugo, during the break, you had said in a way it's a lot better because, you know, when you give that money to the cop, you know that he's using it for something like maybe buying shoes for his little girl or, you know, maybe getting himself a drink or something.
Yeah. That's what I think. That's how that's where I find solace when I have to pay these guys. And that's always better. That's always better than paying my political masters. And, you know, if you pay to one of the minions and they can use the money for something good, they have families, they have, as you said, little girls or little boys, and they can go out and get a drink. And while they're out getting that drink, they're not oppressing us out in the streets. They're having fun.
Yeah, so that's a positive thing.
And that's a good thing. That's there's a lot more honesty in acknowledging your desires. If the policeman wants to rob you and you want to pay the least amount of money possible, that's more honest. You're not saying, okay, you know, I'm really bad. I'm a bad subject. I'm a bad citizen. I did this little thing. You just say, you know, get from me as little as you can. Right. That's more honest.
And this goes back to the libertarian principle that, you know, the government is like a highwayman that robs you, but the difference is that the highwayman robs you and leaves you alone, whereas the government robs you and then chases along behind you to try to convince you that they're doing you a service, and then they'll rob you again and again and again, all the time lying to you, telling you that they're trying to do you a service.
Warm peace to that, Ben.
Yeah. Hugo, thanks for coming on the show, Jim. Good to do another show with you.
Indeed. Always a pleasure.